up? It's the Full 48. I'm Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. We are in the final week of seeding games in the bubble. There's playoffs a week from today, taping this on Monday. A play-in game Saturday. I think that's a first. Memphis and somebody, probably Portland. Before I get to my guest today, a quick reminder, please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. Rate and review me on Apple Podcasts. It's very helpful for the pod and for me, so appreciate that. But without further ado, let me jump right in. My guest today, this is not an exaggeration to call my guest today a legend of sports journalism, a legend in my business. He's a former longtime sports columnist at the New York Times, where we were colleagues for many years. Currently writing for The Undefeated, also host of the Bill Roden on Sports podcast. See, it helps to be able to speak well, Bill, to do a podcast. I'm still learning how to do that. Bill Roden,
you're still a print guy. Hey, Howard, how you doing, man? It's a pleasure to be united again. But, you know, you're a print guy.
Yes. We're winging it. We're winging it. Like, we get these podcasts, they put us on whatever, they say go to it, and then we pretend like we know what we're doing.
Right. It's great to be with you, though.
It's great to see you via Zoom here, and great to be able to chat. It's been a while since we don't get to run into each other in press rooms in NBA arenas anymore for the time.
Right. Maybe ever. Maybe ever again.
Let's hope that that's not the case. So I wanted to bring you on today, Bill, because you had a column on The Undefeated a week ago that I really enjoyed, that was very provocative, which is, knowing you as I do, is what I would expect. And it's also an issue that I've been pondering it just in my own head for a while. I want to read the headline first for folks if they didn't see it on The Undefeated. And the headline was, quote, "Why It's Time for NBA Players to Get Off Their Knees," which, it's funny, Bill. If you took that headline out of context, you might think that that was a Laura Ingraham or Tucker Carlson column.
Oh, and, my God.
Seriously.
I didn't write the headline.
but it's obviously not coming from the perspective that they would. I'm just saying, out of context, it's surprising. And I think that that's what's interesting and provocative about it. So let me read one quick passage from it, and then you can tell me why it's time for players perhaps to get off their knees. So you write, quote, "We are beyond kneeling because the resistance that kneeling represents has been totally hijacked by the very system it aspires to reform." And then you say, "A week into the season, it all seems like a cliche."
Yeah.
It's a striking column and a striking perspective, Bill, because I think most people, depending on your political viewpoint, would look at this and go, well, this is great. The NBA is all united, the players, the referees, the coaches, the league itself. They are behind Black Lives Matter. They are behind this movement. They're on the right side of history. They're trying to keep this front and center. What could possibly be wrong with that? So where is this kind of bothering you at the moment?
Yeah, well, you know, Howard, again, and thanks again for, you know, not only having me on, but giving some exposure to this issue and my work in The Undefeated. But this has been building for a long time. Even when when the NFL declared, you know, they made their statement, Black Lives Matter, and we're going to give the employees Juneteenth off and all that. And I'm like, okay, enough is enough. You know, I mean, really. I'm sort of more into the structural changes. I mean, you know, when you look at the National Football League, even the NBA for that matter, or the Bleacher Report or Sirius Satellite Radio or probably Disney, you know, and when you walk down the corridors of power, where power and control rest, you're not going to see a lot, if any, Black folks there. You know, that's where my head is right now. Where is power and control? I don't need the day off. I don't need the NFL or my Black Lives Matter or the NBA. I'm looking at the C-suite. You know, how many Black executives do you have in the National Basketball Association, in every department, in every single marketing, advertising, PR, departments we don't even know exist. You know, I walked in those corridors, and so have you, Howard. You know, I've been in, you know, seen those being walked by, and I'm just overwhelmed, but just continually struck in disappointment by the whiteness of the whole thing, particularly when you go on the court and you see all these Black guys running around and the NFL, all these Black guys running around. I'm like, okay, where is the power and control? You know, even when you go to like the, you know, ESPN, and that's been an issue even in I guess I'll say our our shop, when they say, okay, it's nice to have some of the black voices front facing. But when you go back, the producers, the executive producers, the shot callers, the people who determine what gets green lit. And that's every single media organization. So, okay, so then we fast forward to the NBA, and they painting the messages all over the court, and people are kneeling. And I'm like, well, where the hell was all this kneeling, you know, 3 months, 4 months ago when guys were scared they couldn't kneel, you know, because this was in my contract. So I just said, listen, man, you know, and particularly when the Jonathan Isaac stood up and all that, I said, the reality is that we're not all in the same boat. If this pandemic has shown anything, we ain't all in the same boat. You know, some people are sheltering in their third house, you know, on the beach. Not I want to let people know that's just the background. You're not at your
yeah,
third house.
Yeah, the beach behind me is yes, completely fake. That is really Hermosa Beach, but I am sadly not there. Just a screenshot.
Yeah. So anyway, so my point, I guess, was, okay, let's get beyond the pantomime and the ceremony, and let's get into, are you going to give up? Are people with power and control going to give up power and control? And the answer to that, since the 18th century, has been no. Mm. We're not giving up power and control without a fight. We'll give you some little crumbs here. We'll, you know, even after this pandemic and the Black Lives, you know, the NBA created a position for a black guy. They created a position called diversity and something, you know, and they said, okay, here, we'll take this. But when I walk down your corridors in the NBA office, in the offices of the 30 NBA teams, the 32 NFL teams, baseball, and I walk through those front offices, and the overwhelming whiteness has not changed. I'm like, so we ain't talking about anything, you know, so get off the knees. I mean, if you want to get a new, fine, but let's deal with, if you have leverage, use your leverage to change the juxtaposition of power and control. So that's
yeah,
kind of what was behind all that.
Absolutely. All right. So there's a lot wrapped up in there. Let me drill down on a couple of these things. So, you know, let me go back to why they're kneeling in the first place, presumably, right? Why the NBA is embracing this, why the NBA has decided to ignore its own rule about standing for the anthem, all of this, right? This kind of begins with George Floyd, and to an extent, Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and a bunch of others. But we are, as a society, as a country, we're at a moment in time where these things have kind of come to a head in a way that I haven't seen in my lifetime. You have certainly seen a little more in your time on this earth than I have. But this is a moment that I have not seen in my lifetime, Bill. And I am, there's a variety of emotions that get tied up in this, but at least some piece of it is hope in that it's got the attention of everybody right now, including people who look like me. If white America is actually embracing this movement, or at least listening, and that those millions who protested in June and July, that we saw the full spectrum of our fellow citizens, right? Like, that's encouraging. And what the NBA is doing right now is being part of that. And on some level, you would think, well, that's what we would hope they would do. And if they turned a blind eye to it, if they decided not to allow the players to kneel, if they put if they drew a hard line there, if they didn't use their programming during the restart to help keep amplifying the issues of police brutality and systemic racism, if they weren't doing all the PSAs and everything that are part of the broadcast, we would be all over them, as we should be, saying, what are you doing? We're at a moment here. There's a, like, don't ignore this. And the players themselves, part of their reluctance to go into the bubble and to play again was, we don't want to detract from the movement. We don't want to take ourselves out of the movement. We need to keep being part of it even as we're playing. So that's what the players wanted to do. That's what the league endorsed and has embraced. So, I, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, well, okay, this may come off as a cliche, as you wrote in one point in your column, and it may feel a little bit like it's corporatized, and I totally get that, but don't we need the NBA in lockstep with its players to do this? Because the players themselves wanted it. They wanted to have this platform.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, that's a great point, Howard. In other words, we don't have to make these binary decisions, and I think that's been the problem. Hmm. We've had to make either this or that, you know, and it doesn't have to be this or that. The problems facing our community, the black community, and other, you know, they're so immense, man. Remember, this has been 400 something years in building, that we need every single weapon. We need the PSAs. We need the handwriting on the court. You know, we need that. So, you know, but we also need, you know, to also break down those doors in the C-suite, you know, and say, hey, you know what, unless there's fundamental change, we need to see more black executives up here. And we need to tell the black executives, and don't be Uncle Tom's, you know, we're not, we just don't need black faces. We need black faces who are committed to change. So you need to fight this war on several fronts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, okay, if you want to kneel, fine. But I'm just saying, don't get caught up. You know, just don't get caught up in the pageantry just because you just, you know, that's what everybody else is doing and everybody's dealing. I'm going to kneel. And what else are you doing? But let me ask you this, though, Howard. I kind of want to go back to what I was saying at the very beginning about power and control. How do you feel about that? Because as somebody who, you know, identifies as quote unquote white, you see this all the time.
Sure.
You've been in meetings, you've walked down the road. What, I mean, you've walked in corridors, you've been in the, you know, what do you think about what I call this overwhelming whiteness of power and control? I mean, you saw it when we were colleagues at the New York Times.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
Going through, you know, and I don't know if you felt like I did, but and thinking about that, you know, when you go inside, you know, you've been in baseball press boxes, you know, you've been in these places where you are one of like a whole bunch of white folks with like one or two black faces. And I guess I'm turning around. What do you think about that? Did it cross your mind that this was like, there's something structurally wrong here? I mean, that's the definition of structural racism. And yeah. That's, you know, I mean, what do you think about that?
No,
what do you think about that?
I would say that you and I can walk down the same hallways at the New York Times as we did and experience that in different ways, right? Like it's going to be more stark and something that you're going to notice much more so than I am. And same thing when I've been at Bleacher Report. I think being if you're white working in institutions that are largely run by white executives, it doesn't strike you the same way because we're just kind of used to it. And it's not as present in thought until we start talking about these issues. And then we start. Right. And so in a moment like this, that's why there has been a reckoning at a bunch of different places, I have to say, including the one I currently work for, over these issues. I would say where it regards the NBA bill, I see a couple different things. Like, obviously, you're right. When you say structural racism, it encompasses all of these things, right? Who's running the teams, who owns the teams, who runs the league. And that is of a piece with, broadly, some of the other issues that ail our country, including police brutality, right? But in this moment, I think what NBA players in the league are focusing on is, okay, at a minimum, it's the police brutality part and some of the things that are wrapped up in that and social justice, racial justice, that are the focus, which is not to say that the other things that you're pointing to aren't all obviously related and intertwined. And listen, some players, Kyrie Irving, I think, was the one who on the conference call that he had held was saying, this is a moment where we should bring to bear these other issues and our leverage to say there should be more black executives at the team level. There should be more black head coaches. And I've written about that at times. It's been a while. I probably should revisit. But yeah, the NBA has, you know, while it gets a great report card every year from Richard Lapchick, who does the diversity racial report cards and gender, they do well on those, but it doesn't mean that the NBA is anywhere close to equitable on those issues. But I see that bill. I don't want to say I'm seeing that as separate and apart from. I just see that this particular moment in August of 2020 as being about the things that led to George Floyd's death and Breonna Taylor's death and all. Like there are specific things that have brought this movement to a head and that the NBA players and the league are participating in. And the issues you're raising are obviously important ones too, but the NBA players, when they're kneeling, they're not protesting against the NBA. They're protesting with the NBA in a way against these deeper structural issues.
But I guess what I'm saying, Howard, is that number one, control your own industry. Okay. Control your own industry, you know, control, make sure your own industry is desegregated and doing what you can do within your industry to stop structural racism, because the two biggest things affecting the black community is income and wealth, the income and wealth gap. That's it. Once you close that income and wealth gap, all this other stuff is gonna stop. You're not gonna have the police. Once you have income and wealth gap, you're not gonna have the police coming into these neighborhoods and being occupation forces, because they're not gonna screw with people who are wealthy. You know, the white police, the police force, ultimate job is to basically protect wealth from those who do not have. You know, that's the, so my whole thing is, okay, let's close the wealth and income gap, and everything else is going to follow. So if I'm in the, if I'm a writer, for example, I'm a writer, black writer, my thing is, okay, what can I do to put more young black people in this pipeline? What can I do to help desegregate the sports industry in which I work? If I'm an NBA player, and again, Howard, we don't have to say either or, right? That we don't have to say, well, okay, Roden, we're kneeling for social justice, and we don't have time to make sure that the front office of the San Diego Spurs is not all white anymore.
Right?
Can't we do both? I mean, that's, you know, right? Okay, you rebound, you shoot, you box out, right? We don't have everybody shooting. We don't have everybody rebound. You know, everybody playing a different role. So why can't we do that in this movement? You know, we thought, okay, you guys deal with the kneeling and the police violence. We're going to deal with desegregating the NBA. We're going to make sure that the NBA does a lot of business now with black vendors, because that's a huge problem. You know, they don't do business with black-owned CPA firms, black-owned law firms. Black, that's a huge business. And, you know, are you investing your money with a Ariel Capital, for example? I mean, those are things, the same thing with NFL or Major League Baseball. So, okay, so yeah, you guys, NFL is going to make a statement. Black Lives Matter. Okay, well, if Black Lives Matter, put some in the C-suite. If Black Lives Matter, do business with black vendors. If black, you know, then they, well, listen, you guys, you kind of hit my pocketbook now. You know, let's just be reasonable, Roden, you know, that kind of stuff. So, so I guess what we're not really disagreeing. How I'm saying is that you could fight battles on multiple fronts,
yeah.
You know, that, you know.
So it's fair to say, which it's not that you have any objection to what the players are doing right now. It's just that it there's more to be done even in their immediate surroundings, right? Like, it's one thing to go out, march, protest, kneel, bring attention to police brutality and other ills in society at large. But while you're at it, you should be pushing the NBA with the leverage you do have as 75% to 80% of the league to make those changes in the front offices to make sure that they're black, right, head coach, more black head coaches and opportunities, because those numbers have stayed. The number of black head coaches, I wrote about this several years ago, at one point it peaked
that 14. Was a great story.
Thank you. So it was 14 at one point and dropped to like 8 or whatever. It's been hovering in like the 6 to 8 range every year since. Number of black executives, like, it depends on how you count it, right? Like, people are saying, like, oh, there's like 6 or 7 GMs. Mark Spears and I talked about this a month ago on this pod, where, okay, but the GM for a lot of teams is actually now essentially like the assistant GM was at one time,
right?
Because now you have team president and a new title. And so a lot of times it's, okay, there's a black GM, but there's a white team president. And so they're not really, right, the final decision maker on basketball ops. So, like, the NBA has lagged or plateaued in those areas. And yeah, sure. I mean, NBA players certainly could be pushing that as well. I think some of them have, but it's not front and center. Right now what's front and center is George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, police, which I get. Again, like, this is a moment that we're in, right, broadly as a country, and I, again, like, that's what allowed the NBA to come to a decision, I think, in the first place, to embrace this level of, I guess, someone has said it's demonstration, not protest, which I think I agree with that definition, right? Like, it's not protest anymore if it's kind of tacitly endorsed. So it's a demonstration, right. And it's a powerful one. Like, I don't want to overstate it, but especially opening night, the first night they did it, Bill, I've never seen every player, every coach, and the referees all take a knee during the anthem. And while they're not necessarily risking anything with the league, because the league is tacitly endorsing it, there's still a risk with the general public, right? Because there's part of the country that's going to view that and say that's wrong, just as they viewed it that way with Kaepernick. Although, I think the country has evolved at least a little bit in the last 4 years. So,
Yeah,
it's just, it's interesting. And I wonder where
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah,
I'm not disagreeing. And that's the key question. So, okay, what's the next level? Because, like anything, man, we become anesthetized so quickly to this stuff. So all of a sudden, you know, you see the Black Lives Matter, and by round 2 of the NBA playoffs, it doesn't really register. And I think, too, the people who object, A, they're either not going to tune in. They may be watching hockey. You know, and I don't see a whole lot of Black Lives Matter on, but yeah, let's not go down that road. Let's not go down that road.
No, but you're right. But you're right. There are people who weren't watching in the first place, and they're just teeing off on this because it's convenient to, and it's an opportunity to bash the NBA, to bash the movement or whatever else, but they weren't watching in the first place. And that includes that includes the president, by the way, who was never watching the NBA in the first place.
Right.
We don't need to go down that road.
So and speaking of that road, I think I'm going to see in November. I mean, we're talking about all the speculation. If there's a significant change in November, then I'm ready to say, okay, I, as a nation, there are enough decent-minded people who said enough of this. Whether I'm an independent, whether I'm a Republican, whether I'm a Democrat, you know, I believe in the United States of America and this great experiment that we're in. Enough that we need to, you know, enough of the hatred, enough of the divisiveness. We're going to make a change. And I will then be very heartened. You know, right now, it's a lot of talk. And to get back to the point we're kind of have a little minor tug of war about is that, yeah, I'm agreeing with you about the opening day and the kneeling and all that. I'm saying, okay, fine, but put your money where your mouth is. Give up some power and control.
Yeah.
Okay? Give up some power and control. You know, which historically does not happen without a struggle. You know, you can kneel and all that, fine. But also, you know, let's deal with where you go to bed at night, which is, you know, your three or four houses that you got around the world, you know, and let's close this wealth and income gap. And what can we do to do that? Because at the end of the day, man, that's, you know, wealth and income gap closing means better access to education. It means it solves almost every single an end to police brutality, because again, when you do not have impoverished neighborhoods, you're not going to have cavalier police forces, you know, basically acting as occupation forces, because they don't do that at Scarsdale. You know, they don't do that at your wealthy. You don't see them doing that. And trust me, there's stuff going on in these wealthy neighborhoods too, but because they are part of the economic power base, those people get a lot more latitude. They have a lot more sway in the courts and all that. So that wealth and income, man, wealth income relates to power and control.
Yeah.
And when all that stuff is aligned, man, a lot of stuff we're talking about, you don't have to, it will take care of itself. So we're saying the same thing. I'm just saying we could do it all. We don't have to just choose one. Maybe you're saying, well, if you have to focus on one, which would it be? And I'm saying, well, you don't have to focus on one.
no doubt. Maybe the thing to do right now in the wake of this swell of support for the Black Lives Matter movement is to be part of that and keep amplifying that while they're playing in the bubble. And then maybe when this season is over and we're moving on to next season, that's the way to keep the momentum going on the broader issues of racial justice would be to then, okay, we're, you know, that there are people in the halls of power are working on, hopefully, the police brutality or whatever. Now we as NBA players can turn our focus back to our own surroundings and to the league. And maybe that is the next thing. Maybe they say, listen, now that we've got your attention, now that we're all united and we've all been speaking with one voice in a lot of ways, let's bring that to bear on the league itself. Maybe that does happen next when next season starts and we're back to, maybe I'm not predicting normalcy or back in home markets, but whenever that moment happens, Bill, and people are able to kind of regroup and get that normalcy in their day-to-day lives, maybe that's a time when NBA players do use the leverage and the voice that they have discovered right now to turn to that. I don't know. Obviously, there are some voices, because Kyrie and some others did raise that some weeks ago, so we'll see. But let me ask you about that, Bill, just more broadly. I have not seen, again, in my time, I've been covering the league for 23 years, this is the most activism, however you want to classify it, this is the most activism I've seen by NBA players or by athletes in general. This is a moment where it seems like more guys than ever feel comfortable expressing themselves, whether it's marching, whether it's protesting, whether it's kneeling, whether it's writing essays, whether it's whatever they're doing. And again, I think that, like, that to me is a corner that once you've turned it, I don't think we're going back. I think that now that NBA players are fully engaged in this and feel comfortable with it in a way that maybe they didn't before, and it's been a slow, it's been a gradual evolution. I wrote about this a few weeks back, that LeBron James in 2012 with the Heat doing their Trayvon Martin photo in their hoodies, that was the beginning, I think, of this gradual change where, and LeBron and Wade and Carmelo, Chris Paul, like they've all they got this thing rolling with the ESPY speech. And so now we're at a point where everybody, no matter where their station is in the league, feels comfortable. Again, to me, I don't want to get Pollyannish about it, but I feel like this is a sea change. This is a moment where, like, that you're not going back after that. That they've found their voice and they're using it, and maybe we will see some of the other things that you're hoping to see with the from them because of that.
Yeah, well, a couple things. I will wait and see. I think the only reason you've had all this change is because of pressure, because we saw these murders of people on live TV, and people are kind of freaked out, and you can't hide from the truth. And there have been riots, and not riots, but there's been protests and unrest and all that stuff. When it dies down, that's, we'll see. You know, when the gun's no longer to your head, you know, we'll see. But also, you know, look at what the WNBA is doing. That's no joke. I mean, the WNBA, you have Maya Moore, who quit basketball so she could focus on freeing a man who had been incorrectly sentenced. That's activism, ACT.
And she was successful, by the way. And she
And she did it. Yeah. She did it. You've got WNBA players now. There is a co-team owner in Atlanta who's actually been antithetic to Black Lives Matter, and they've gone to taking T-shirts saying supporting her rival. You know, could you imagine NBA players? And let's see if they can do this. Let's see if NBA players who, you know, I applaud LeBron for being part of an initiative to get get people to register to vote and to fight voter suppression. But could you imagine a scenario where, you know, come September or even like late August, whatever, once Biden announces his vice president choice, could you imagine a scenario where NBA players are now wearing Biden, whatever, T-shirts, support Biden? Now, does that mean that you won't have a couple wearing other T-shirts? Okay, but let's say players decide, okay, we're going to get beyond talking. We want this guy to go. So on our warm-up jerseys, we're going to switch from Black Lives Matter to support Biden.
Or dump
POTUS 45. You know what I'm saying? Now that puts the NBA, we know what the NFL is going to do. The NFL, with all those guys supporting the president, they're probably going to put a ban on it. You cannot wear anything supporting a political candidate, right?
Yeah.
What happens if the NBA does that? That to me, or the WNBA, that to me, now we're heading back to protest. If your reaction is, you know, now we're getting back to protest, because that's a great distinction. Demonstration versus protest is when the powers that be say, you cannot do this. And we say, no, we're going to do it anyway. So will NBA players feel strong enough, you know, to take this kneeling and say, you know what, we're going to put on a T-shirt saying dump whatever or support whatever? Now, man, that to me, that's a major statement. I mean, that's a major statement of activism. So everything you said is fine, but I'm not waiting until next year. I'm in this moment. I'm in today while the fire is raging, you know, while things are hot, heated. Let's do it now. Let's not wait until next year. It's too late. Right now is the time.
Yeah.
That's why I am.
And where would you place LeBron in all this? I mean, he's clearly taken on, like, you and I both saw obviously the Michael Jordan years in that era, and it's not to put it all on Michael Jordan, but as the standard bearer of that era, the whole, you know, Republicans wear sneakers too, buy sneakers too stuff.
Right.
Like that was the ethos of that era. Nobody was really speaking out much aside from, right, you know, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, Craig Hodges. There were great consequences for that. But so now LeBron is the standard bearer, and he has clearly taken, now it's not like he's some radical out there. And he's not, you know, it's not to place him on a level necessarily with some of the people that he says are his role models in this, and Muhammad Ali and others. But I don't know where to place that. And maybe we have to wait until his career is over to decide how to define or interpret his role in pushing activism forward within the athletic realm. But like, he's definitely staked out some territory here that is new And that was not a place that anybody was occupying before him in this league immediately before him, right? Kareem was kind of, you know, and Bill Russell, they were on their own. But there was a long span where there was almost no one, and certainly nobody at that superstar level. So how do you define or interpret or view or contextualize LeBron's role in moving this thing forward or in making the league more amenable to this?
Yeah, I mean, LeBron has, I think, like you said, in terms of pushing activism forward, is basically just, and the bar for so long was so low. You know, the bar was so low.
Yeah.
You know, because of people like Michael Jordan, even before, where people, you know, again, you know, power, that's why they call it power structure, because they are powerful and they can make or break your career. And I think LeBron has just, and people like this, hey, man, it's okay just to be a citizen who can voice your opinion, whether it's for Black Lives Matter or just very basic human treatment. I think you correctly point out, this is more of a coordinated effort. I mean, in other words, there's more people, and I think that's the secret to moving anything forward, is to have numbers, to have large numbers, not just, you know, Bill Russell or a Kareem or this guy or that guy, but to have, as an athletic community, to come together. But if you're a partner on Wall, a Black partner on Wall Street, you know, you're not as visible. But I think wherever you are African-American and find yourself and find Black people underrepresented, marginalized, disenfranchised, I think it's incumbent on you to gather numbers to protest that. LeBron, athletes just have a larger stage. But I think that whether you're a journalist, whether you're in a big real estate company, wherever you find yourself as African-American and you find racism, it's kind of your obligation to your ancestors to root it out. And these acts of heroism, that's sort of has been the bedrock of activism, these unrecorded acts of heroism. People may not know it, they may never see it, but you do it. LeBron and people like that just put a face on it. But I think that this has to be it, because racism is a disease that infects every level of our existence in this country. And I think if you're a white people, you ask me what I would say. Yeah, I mean, you know, 1968, you know, yeah, I saw the riots and all that. But a lot of those white people, Howard, a lot of those white people were hippies then, who are now like in their late 60s, 70s, shit, they're part of the problem now. You know, because they decided, okay, this shit's too hard, let me go back to being white. You know, I had fun. It was cool, you know, being a flower child and all that. But now the fruits of privilege are just too powerful to resist. I want the house in the Hamptons. I want, you know, all my kids to have the best education. I want, you know, and to be able to forfeit that by doing something structural, they decide at a certain point in their life, age 35 or 40, you know what, F that. It's, you know, I'm going to go back to privilege. So I've seen that before. I've been on that merry-go-round. And that's what this kind of is, in a way, is a gigantic merry-go-round. And you go round and round, and maybe you travel 5,000 miles on this merry-go-round. But when you stop and get off, you're in the same place you were when you got on.
Yeah.
You know, and too often, that's what I've seen. So we've had this conversation. I guess my thing is, okay, Howard, we'll see.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see. I know what this moment feels like, but it's a moment. You know, it's a moment. Whether it's something larger than a moment, whether it's a movement, whether it's something, we'll see in 5, 10, 15 years. But for the time being, the time is now. So while folks are, you know, whether it's corporations, you look at your bottom line, whatever the motivation is to kind of open the door, you better go through it now, because that door is not going to be open for much longer.
Yeah. And you're right, obviously, to put it in that historical context. And you've seen these moments kind of come and go, too. So I'm trying to remain optimistic that, you know, what we've seen in the last couple of months in this country is indicative of something lasting, something enduring. But you're right, too, that, you know, we'll know in November on some level. And obviously, that's only one step two. There's much to do beyond that, but at a minimum,
that'll be a major step.
That would be a major step. November
some,
at
some
a minimum.
Steps are, yeah. So some steps are larger than others.
Yeah. No.
All steps are not created equal.
No doubt. Well, there's a lot of other roads we could go down with this discussion. I would love to have it longer, but I know you've got a deadline, which, because we are both still writers first and foremost, we still have deadlines to deal with and editors to deal with. And I don't want to get you crossed up with your editors there at The Undefeated. So
that's right. Never cross editors. We've learned that lesson. Never cross editors.
No, they can make your life difficult. Bill, this has been great, man. I'm so glad I finally got to get you on the podcast. I was on yours a few years back, and this was overdue. My bad, but I'm glad to finally get a chance to do this.
Hey, Howard, the pleasure's mine, man. You're always one of the good guys in the industry.
No, I appreciate that, man. I will let you get back to it. Look forward to reading your next piece on The Undefeated. And also, of course, folks, check him out there and check out his podcast, Bill Roden on Sports, which I think is probably located in all the same places that this podcast is located. Apple, Spotify, all that good stuff. Bill, it's been great, man. Thank you.
Hey, Howard, thank you very much, man. Take care.